Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode. Just a reminder, if you didn't listen to the last one, I'm going to be jumping right into the interview, and if you want to hear me ramble on and talk about whatever's been on my mind for a while, you can check in with me at the end after the commercial break.
Who thinks it's their obligation to go on stage and compromise their dignity to bring in some people and share laughter and share joy? And that really is that principle, and that coming from, you know, that was the big transition, coming from a pessimist, really understanding that principle of sharing joy, and then turning that. So how can we do activism, or how can we move forward with remembering that we can all sit down and laugh together?
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to At Least There's This, a show about some of the small good things in our world of hurt. I'm Alex Schiffman, and it's been a bit since I've done this show. I'll get into that more. I'm not sure when I'm going to be releasing each episode as I do them. I'm kind of doing them in a block. But it's still sort of the tail end of the pandemic, and things are bad. Things ain't great. India at this moment is really falling apart with COVID. There is unrest in Myanmar. Activists are getting shot, and things are just as bad as they've ever been, although there's light at the end of the tunnel with COVID in America, but that's just here. But in a world where there is unrest and pain everywhere, at least there's...
the circus.
Hi, everybody. I am with activist, organizer, and performer Chet Monday, and we're going to be talking about the circus. But before we do, Chet, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Well, originally I was going to answer a pessimistic optimist, because I think that we need to be realistic about every situation that there is in an optimistic way. We need to look for the best parts of the realistic bad things that are happening.
Okay, well, can you give me like an example?
So, you know, I think that a go-to in it, which falls in my line of work, is within climate activism. You know, the reality of the climate crisis is huge, and we need to be as pessimistic as possible in believing all of the worst effects and catering to them. But we need to be optimistic about how we approach and deal with them. You know, like with new jobs, you know, that is such a positive word, I guess, in America at least, to put on to... you know, something that's deemed as a crisis, right? A great, you know, band-aid, if you will. So in an optimistic way to be realistic, I guess.
How did you come to that kind of mindset? Like, were you always optimistic with a pessimistic bent, or did you start out purely optimistic, or vice versa?
I'm pretty sure I started out very pessimistic. I think that, you know, when you're 16 or 17 and you're in high school and Trump just got elected, and you know, you're on the internet all the time and you're learning about all of the real terrors of the world for that period of your life, you know, and when you first start getting into a lot of activism, it's because you're angry and you think that everything's going bad as possible, because it feels like it is, and you want to do something about it. But once you start trying to do something about it, you learn that you can't do that with anger or just sadness. You have to do it with passion and a lot of optimism.
So, yeah, you're probably the first Gen Z I've ever had on this podcast.
Trailblazer.
Right, you really are. So how did you get into activism from such a young age?
A lot of that goes to my parents. I was kind of inadvertently in a lot of different, like, intergovernmental crises before the time I was 10. Because, you know, we traveled around the world all the time. And so I've been held in, you know, Chinese visa facilities. We went to Amman, Jordan when I was about 7 years old. So that was the first time I was packing a U.S. Army shirt that I had got given down, like, from just a friend or something. And we were packing to go to Amman, Jordan, and my dad was like, don't put that in the suitcase. And I was like, that's so weird. And when I got there and saw the tanks, I was like, cool, I get it now. And so that, you know, that just that all of those in sequence growing up and then turning 16 and going to a very progressive performing arts school and Trump being elected and witnessing the shock and damage it had on a group of creative visionaries, that kind of rocketed me forward and wanted to be, you know, a voice for all these artists that I was a in community with.
So there's, I mean, so many places I want to go with this, because obviously we're here to talk about the circus, and you just kind of got us into that. But I think, you know what? No, I am going to follow that, and we'll get back to my other question later. So you were traveling around the world with your parents, and I assume that's because you were traveling with them to perform in the circus.
Correct. So my father, his fraternity, when he was in college in the 70s, dared him to audition for Ringling Brothers Clown College. He did it, and then he got in, and he decided to join the circus with Ringling. And then he, you know, started his own circus. He hired my mother on as a choreographer, the LA Circus, and that's when they met. And he integrated her into his act, and they started clowning together, and they became partners. And then my dad became the director of the Ringling Brothers Clown College in the 90s. And after that, you know, they moved to New York, had me, and that's when we started traveling with the Big Apple Circus. And that's the circus that I grew up on.
Wow. Did you perform at all with them as a kid, or is that not kosher?
Well, I was about 1 to 3 years old during that whole sequence, and I was not in the act. However, many of the other kids were. There was about like 10, you know, it's a circus. So the thing about circus lots is there's a lot of kids all the time. Because if you're a circus performer, you have to have kids, or else no one else is going to do your act when you can't do it. So, you know, there's this mindset that, you know, I'm going to have a bunch of kids, they're going to spend all their time on the circus lot, and they're going to learn how to carry this tradition on. And so we were all part of, the kids were all part of this version of the show called Midnight Clowns that Big Apple did every year. And it was pretty much a gala where all the real performers got drunk and watched the crew and the kids and the directors of the circus recreate the circus in some way. So when I was one, I was in the dog act. So we just used all of the dog act set and I went around and fell down the slide and whatnot and did that. But that was the only time I did it when I was that young.
Okay, so you haven't performed, or have you performed since?
So my parents started integrating me into the act when I was about 5 or 6, I think. My sister and I have a younger sister. She's 3 years younger than me. We were both pretty musically inclined. We liked doing like theater. We first got introduced to that when we were like 6 or 7 and moved to Texas. And we were started doing productions because my mom was like, "These kids need to get on stage." And so it was natural for us. And then they taught me how to juggle, and I started doing juggle cameos in their shows. And then my sister and I started to do like singing acts together. The first one was when I was probably about 8 or 9, and we did Billionaire by Bruno Mars, and I rapped the rap verse of that part, and my sister sang the Billionaire, but she was like 6 and like singing this Bruno Mars song. But you know, my parents have always been as willing to integrate us to the act as possible. However, my sister and I, you know, in growing up, we weren't always like, "Yeah, we want to be on stage with our clown parents." You know, there was a lot of growing pains.
Yes, I can imagine. Which makes me curious why that has now become something that you think is positive. Because a lot of people, no matter what it is their parents do, even if it's something that me as an outsider think like, oh, how wonderful, the circus, you know, you grow up and you think, I don't want to be involved in that at all, right? But for you, I asked you, what do you think is actually good about the world? And you're like, I want to talk about the circus. So can you lead me through how you transitioned from, I'm not sure I want to be a part of this, to like, this is a genuinely good thing?
Yeah, it's a good question because there are a lot of downsides to the circus with everything. And I think that's what made the circus so appealing for me is that growing up, you know, it was just something that my parents did and I learned to be integrated into it. And I didn't like it at first because I grew up, you know, in Irving and going to public school, I was forced into a very masculine culture. Like I was in Boy Scouts and I played sports. And so my whole problem with the circus was that I was in this like it felt very feminine to me and very like target on my back. So that was my first problem. But you know, in time, I met a lot of my best friends there because they were different than the people that you met at school. They had a similar like understanding of what your background was. Like they've been traveling a lot their whole lives. They know the same kids and other circus acts that you do. And I realized that my community that I was building with these people that I saw one time in Shanghai and one time in Florida and one time on the Big Apple when we were kids, we're gonna be around forever and doing the same thing. And I could always go see them. I keep up with my circus friends more than like a lot of people because that community, it's a family for however long you're doing that. And I think that's what proved it to me. And it was also the travel because, you know, with the parents being clowns, and I guess I'll focus more on that because that was the big thing. It's like your parents, my parents make a fool of themselves on stage for a living, and that consumes their, you know, what they do. And I had to understand, okay, why do I like this, or am I ashamed of it? And and I think that once I grew up and realized that every kid that saw my parents performed or heard about my parents, if they weren't afraid of clowns, they loved it. They like idolized these people. And so I just watched my parents inspire the kids around me. Like my best friend from middle school is now pursuing clowning. Like he is on a circus lot. Yeah, he's on a circus lot in Florida. We were best friends throughout elementary and middle school. He like took all my parents' circus classes and he's like doing that for real now. So I watched firsthand how they got all these people to fall in love with art form and in love with the community. And I think that's really what brought me to positive.
And so has that shifted your perspective on how you see the world in general? Because you were saying that growing up, right, you kind of had the same machismo attitude about the world that a lot of boys do. But it seems like that was a then thing, like that isn't a now thing. And is it the circus that helped you get out of that?
I think so, because, you know, and I think it was the circus along with high school, because I came out of the public school system. I guess I went to another public school, but it was a magnet school. Everyone there is there to do some sort of art. So there's already like an understanding of like, okay, this is what we think is cool now. I know you thought like Nike Elites and like shorts and like football was cool like last year, but now we're into all of this art and beauty and whatnot. So that transition immediately, I was like, oh wait, this is really cool. This is perfect for this culture. And could you repeat the question? I got a little bit of that part.
No, for sure. So the question was like, it was more of like you transitioned from a machismo masculinity, right, when you were a kid, like I think a lot of boys did and a lot of men are trying to do now, into something where you're more sensitive or you're less uncomfortable with something that could be perceived as feminine. And I was asking, did the circus change that, or did you change and it made it easier for you to accept the circus?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the circus definitely laid the foundation for me to be able to make that transition. It gave me the context and the experience to say, these are very proud people. This is my, like, what I think that is right for me is not right for everyone. You know, like, a great example is we had this woman named Sharshi on the Lone Star Circus, which is a Texas-based circus that we started working with when we got here. And she would go around in the costuming before each show, and she would put like little bedazzled like diamonds and jewels on every boy and put glitter on them and say, you look beautiful. And I would never let it happen. I was like, get away from me. Like, I don't want it. And then I started letting her say yes. And I remember seeing a picture of me, you know, wearing, and I was like, that's awesome. I think I look great with glitter. So that definitely laid the foundation, but I really credit it to the amazing women in activism. And when I started getting into activism and in reading and understanding more about current events and women's issues, they really did a good job of creating education in terms of large social, you know, the Me Too movement was one of the greatest educational like movements for young men, because before that there was nothing in terms of like growing up from, you know, from going to high school. Like I maybe took one sex ed class in middle school, never once mentioned the word consent, right? Like there is an obvious education issue. So I think that, you know, I just being on like Twitter and Instagram and being a part of these social movements, That's when I made the largest leap from an already, kind of ready to get there,
I can't tell you how lucky I think Gen Z men are. From like as a millennial guy, where I had to like, this all happened in college or post-college for me, And all the men who are younger than me are like, yeah, no, we learned this as we became men. I'm like, fuck, you had so much less to unlearn than like the men my age and older, where we're like, oh yeah, I got like the Han Solo thing baked into me, and then was taught like, no, you were wrong. It's like, ah, fuck, now I have to like unlearn this and walk this all back. And I am so envious of men your age that you got to come up.
I think about that a lot, and like I hear you on that. And even for me, like, I'm envious of the guys that are 3 or 4 years younger than me still, because when I think that that really started, the first huge like movement or big push started when I was 16, I think. Mm-hmm. And even then, you're starting these learned behaviors of masculinity and how you look at this since you're like, eight. Like, I was in Boy Scouts, right? Like, that's right. All of my influences were just these men that I looked up to that were wrong. And so it was a quick unlearn. And I'm thankful for the education that we got,
And I can't help but think, how like what a perfect crucible of a mature man and an activist to have in the circus, right? Like, there is, because it's a subversive place, and I think a lot of, like, I am not principally an activist, though I spend time with activists and I love supporting activists in any way that I can. And I'm becoming more of one as I get older. But the best activism from me as an outsider seems to come from a realization of like, oh, the way things are isn't how they have to be. And there's no reason we're just saying it must be like this, right? And certain art forms don't change the status quo, right? But the circus, I think part of our cultural obsession with it, especially when it comes to horror and like the uncanny, is that it's not like pop culture. It's not like music, There's something different about it.
And I think what that is, and I think about this all the time, is that circus as an art form, I think, is the most aggressively and democratically inclusive art form, because it is quite literally rounding up whoever was not welcome into the conventional art forms. Who, you weren't in the opera, but you can do some things that are like, come join the circus, right? A lot of that I learned from my parents, and that ideal that you're talking about, that crucible of activism, is the fact that, my parents are going to these places, and regardless of, what the kids look like, where they are, what their background's like, they will bring needs to communities, whether they need a laugh if they're in a hospital or a refugee hospital. That's why we were in Jordan. My parents went to entertain at like 3 different refugee hospitals, because they're, after the circus and after we moved back to Texas, they branched into hospital clowning. And so they have 2 programs here in Dallas and 1 in Boston. But watching them, go into a hospital and for the sole purpose of cheering up the kids while they're doing, getting dialysis or whatever they may be doing there, and making it feel like a safer place, or going to a refugee hospital and the same thing in Jordan, and watching just my parents speak to a bunch of these refugees that probably didn't speak English, but making them laugh so hard from the physical comedy of the aspect, and just the crowded in the courtyard waiting for something that was, a bright spot in their day. And I think, like, who thinks it's their obligation to go on stage and compromise their dignity to bring in some people and share laughter and share joy? And that really is that principle. And that coming from, that was the big transition, coming from a pessimist, really understanding that principle of sharing joy, and then turning that. So How can we do activism, or how can we move forward with remembering that we can all sit down and laugh together? You know, like what, how do we make
Right. I was listening to a podcast I've been listening to. It's called What's Left of Philosophy. It's a leftist philosophy podcast. Great. Highly recommend. Will recommend again on this show. I forget which writer they were talking about. I'll look it up later. But this like leftist philosopher was bemoaning why activism has to be so dour, right? Like this should be We should like to be here. Why don't we like to be here? If we aren't enjoying each other's company, then we're doing it wrong. Have you found that the humbling that you're talking about, right? Because you do keep using that language, that what your parents as clowns do is humble themselves in front of other people to make them laugh or to bring them in. Has that taught you important life lessons as a human and as an organizer?
a lot. I think so. This was the biggest challenge for me, and still is a lot of the time. And I like to use there. I saw a comedy show at BAM in Brooklyn like 2 years ago, I think. And they have this great description of comedy, and talks about how humans are so vertically obsessed, and that's why it's funny when somebody falls down. We think in ways of ground to sky, and sky is the limit, and sky is the best, and ground is not so good. So it's like growing up, I saw my parents, you know, doing a falling chair gag and like, you know, honking horns and getting laughs and stuff. And I was like, I gotta be regal. I need to be like the prince of the clowns. Like, can I make this happen? Like, can I just be the solemn one out of the family? And I've stayed like pretty true that, and activism didn't help that in my family's eyes. I've consistently been the unfunny, the like, you know, the stoic Monday, or tried to be, right? And
The
so
Stoic Monday is such a good title. It could be a great title for a short film, for anything.
I this
Chet,
this
but Chet Monday is a hell of a name.
Thank you. So funny story about that. My dad is neither of my parents are named Monday. My dad's name is Milholland, and my mom's name is Riley. And my dad, when he moved to LA, he lived near Mulholland Drive, and he put out something that said called Richard Milholland, and people couldn't pronounce his name right. They would say Mulholland. And so he told them, he was like, call Dick Monday. But he was just saying Monday at that point, and they call him and say, hey, this is Dick Monday, and he was like, yes, it is. And so his clown name became Monday. Their clown names are Slappy and Monday, and that's what they've kind of marketed as forever. And so when you're born at the hospital, they were like, what name should we give our kids? And they were both like, let's do Monday. And it's neither of your names, but it's totally legal to put that down, just like there.
Really?
But yeah, no, that's how it happened. And so that's how we're named Monday. But funny about the Stoic Monday, I made a film, a short film for like a class in high school about my dad, about me like sneaking or seeing my dad putting on clown makeup and him like telling me to get out of the room. And then me coming back in and trying to put the clown makeup on for the first time. And my dad catching me and like yelling me. And we have a huge fight.
Right.
He's like yelling at me. And then I go in and I try one more time, and he catches me, and then he helps me put on the clown makeup. And it was just like an over grander version of how I like pushed this away for so long. And then, you know, with adolescence, and I think with the world that we were coming into at like 17 or 18, you just accept it. And you're like, why?
It that you came of age in the Trump years, I can only imagine what that's going to do to your whole age bracket.
I mean, the thing was, I think for me, and the circus definitely played a lot into this, is you feel like an independent person. You feel like you've done, like in every, like in my middle school, I had like a 13-year-old God complex, because I had already been to China and like the Middle East, and I was, you know, a lot of these kids have never been on a plane before. So I had this like maturity complex of like getting there before, and I think that I started to pretend like I was an adult as soon as Trump came into office. And that was like my sophomore, junior year of high school. So that naturally, that was the time when I started just solidifying, like, I'm going to be this dude, right? Like that, you know, I came into the school and I was like figuring everything out. And then I started, you know, puberty finished its course. And I was like, let's do this thing. And that was also another machismo thing, is how do we deal with the times right now? Are we going to fall victim to just the terrible like dread that it brings over you, which I did a lot? Or are you going to save yourself a little bit by joining the fight? And I think I chose that route because I said, you know, we're the target, or and obviously not me, but like the artists that I worked with were the targets mm-hmm. of this. Like that was a sad day in the school when he got elected.
Yeah.
And so for me to say, either I can just, you know, be sad with them because I know they're going to, the repercussions of this, I know they're not going to affect me that much. Or I can, you know, start to do something about it and really try to help the artist community, because I wasn't completely sold on doing art either. I had a bad case of like the capitalism scaries in high school, and I was. And especially when you're going to a school with artists and your theater teacher says to the whole class, I lose sleep at night sending you off to school to get art degrees. And I was like, all right then. So, you know, it was hard. So,
you'll go into the very lucrative career of activism.
Yes, exactly. I was like, this is the moneymaker.
Right, yeah. Raking in all that money fighting for climate justice. So how did you land on climate?
So I started with gun violence. That was the first in 2018 after the Parkland shooting. My school is in downtown Dallas, my high school, and as soon as the Parkland shooting happened, you know, we were already aware of all the school shootings, but this was normal for us at this point. Before Parkland, we were already like, everyone was just, it was a regular school day thought for all of us to be like, what would we do if like a school shooter ran in the door right now? Like we were always talking about that shit. Like it was just, you know, and so by the time that Parkland happened, I was watching Emma Gonzalez and all the Parkland students, and I was like, this is our school. This could happen at our school. And we have lockdowns every other month because someone gets shot like down the street. We're in the middle of an urban area. Like it's right downtown. Right. And so we started to organize. And the thing, I think the real part of that wanted me to get involved is that I thought it was going to be easy. I was like, oh, cool. If they're doing that in Florida, our performing arts school can do something just as powerful, right? Like, and so I started to get students together and try to get teachers to like organize a walkout because there was a big national walkout. But, and all of this performing arts school, our principal was pretty conservative. And
really?
And he was like, there's gonna be some district pushback on this after I pitched it to him. And so I led this pretty much like, not schmear campaign, but this staff campaign where I got staff and students to sign on and this huge persuasive letter to bring it to him. And he's like, okay, you're going to have to talk to my boss, have a meeting with his boss. And we like go up the district to get all of the permitting like in line and get it all together. And so that pissed me off more than, you know, like a lot of things. I was like, oh, the problem here isn't that, you know, there's nobody trying to solve these issues. Is the problem is the people stopping the people trying to solve these issues. So how do we get past these barriers and have a shot at it? And so I started there and did that through, well, immediately after that, we organized that. And you know, Matt, that's when I met Matt, because he heard that I was organizing this at my school, and he invited all the students organizing a walkout to come into a meeting where he asked me to join the organizing team for the March for Our Lives Dallas. And that was the satellite march.
I know Matt, but for people listening at home, Matt, what's Matt's last name? Tranchin? President of March for Science, which is the organization Chet works for. That's how I met Chet, because my show, Science the Show, has done some work with March for Science. And do you want to really quickly give what March for Science does?
For sure. Yeah. So March for Science is a science advocacy organization. We focus on a bunch of different things. Obviously, climate justice is a big scientific issue. Public health, and also democracy and justice in general. So I think, you know, we often miss a lot of the times that science plays a part in gun violence, on topic, or a lot of other, you know, justice issues within the United States. So, yeah, that's what March for Science does. We have a bunch of different global campaigns focusing on different things. But March for Science was my first dip into the climate justice movement and the overall science justice. And I first interacted with March for Science after I met Matt Tranchin. And he got me on the organizing committee of the March for Our Lives Dallas, asking for, you know, in solidarity with Parkland, that was the big satellite march. And then out of that, that student organizing team formed a group called Students March, which we expanded our view to many different issues, gun violence, science, immigration issues. And it was all, our angle was from the scope of young people. We are students, and this is how we advocate for these issues. These are the points that we stand on, right? And I left that, and I went to college. I went to John Cabot University in Rome, an American university, studied political science for a year, and it was going into 2020. And after a year of studying political science and looking at the U.S. going into another presidential election year, I was like, well, I can't be here. So I called Matt, and I was like, listen, man, I want to be on a campaign. And he was like, okay, let me talk to some people and see what would be a good fit for you. And I wanted to work for Bernie, and I got in touch with a member of the Bernie campaign for an interview. And after 2 weeks, I had gone through the interview process and went really well. Matt called me back and he said, hey, you shouldn't go to Iowa and work for Bernie. You should come work with me on March for Science. And this was a really, really great position, because what March for Science needed was someone to understand like the Gen Z angle of the mm-hmm. climate crisis, because March for Science has been an organization run by scientists or science advocates that are very well established. They have a lot of high credibility, and our team does. We have an amazing team, but oftentimes they're not in touch with the Greta Thunbergs or the Shea Bastidas of the world. So I was kind of brought in to feel the pulse and understand the movement a little bit more, which was perfect for what I had studied in my work with people and how interested I was in meeting new people, and advocating for issues, finding ways to connect and organize. So that's kind of how I transitioned to climate.
So I can't help, seeing myself at your age and how frightening everything you're saying sounds, right? Like how frightening getting involved in like a very loud bit of activism, being confident enough to say, I think how I'm feeling is correct, right? Because as a child, even now, even at 31, I still struggle sometimes with like, I know how I feel about certain things is morally right and morally good, but I still feel like, I don't know if I should, I probably shouldn't say that, right? And then for you to go to college in another country, which is brave in its own way, and then want to come back and say, you know what? No, I have a better thing to do right now than to be studying in college, is very brave. And I think, here's what I want to follow. I mean, you grew up in the fucking circus, man, right? Like, did that just grind down your fear?
I think so. I mean, and I'll be honest, I'm a scared kid. I've been a scared kid. Like, I was scared of everything, like, as a child. But I think when you're going, because the thing is like, it's not that my view of like traveling around the world, like, obviously there's horrors of it, but at the end of the day, you're a kid that's lucky enough to be traveling around with a band of adults who have devoted their life to making people laugh, who all hang out together. So my view of the world was, I can have an awesome band of family and new friends everywhere I go, and bringing that with me, because I had to go in with my little sister to like Mexico City, where I've never met anyone before. My parents were hired as the star clowns of this circus. And then start day one, and you build that community, and then you miss it at like hell when you're gone. And so it gives you that global mindset. So the traveling wasn't as hard for me. The work commitment, on the other hand, was huge for me, because the circus work schedule is based on your 5 minutes on stage. Like, everyone has an act, and however many shows there are in a day, you're required to be on stage for those 5 minutes and maybe the finale, right? And so your life is devoted on pacing yourself, on training yourself, on selling yourself. So, you have to be your own agent. You have to create your own reels, your cuts, and you have to sell yourself to circuses to get a spot on stage. And so that kind of that mindset taught me, well, if there's an opportunity, I need to take it. And I've been very lucky with those opportunities leading me to career decisions. As much as I, you know, don't necessarily think that as young people, especially at my age, after going through that, we shouldn't be making career decisions before we've really understood what we want to do, you know, because that was my 17-year-old brain is what led me to where I am right here. And obviously I have a lot of different perspectives on what I want to do and how I want to do it. But the lucky thing about this is that a lot of things are intersectional. So you learn how to put those together.
On the show, right, I like to say only ever ask like three specified questions. The first one is the one I asked you first, if you're an optimist or a pessimist. And then the second two are the idea of good, right? And we get at it, but it's sort of like once we've been talking for a while, I want to try to clarify and see, you know, look back at what we've said. So they are, how is your thing big G good, right? Like this idea of good in a more philosophical sense, right? Like how is the circus good that it exists? And the other is small G good, right? So how is it, you know, good? How is it good for you? How does it make your life a little better? And I think we've gotten to both, but I'm curious to have you reflect on that.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty simple. The big G is the, you know, it's hard to picture this because circus seems like a dying art form a lot of the time, but it really isn't, because the generations of circus families run strong. And I think that big G good is the integration of art, the radical inclusivity, and general joy that the circus brings. And I think that little G good is everyone's personal experience with the circus, because, you know, when you say circus, you know, my whole life growing up has been saying my life in the circus, or just saying, you know, like, yeah, I grew up in the circus, and that being reflected by whatever the person I'm talking to's experience with the circus is, whether they went one time and there was a fire and it was crazy and they hate the circus, or they go every year and they love the circus, or, you know, everyone has some kind of perspective of the circus. And I think that's the little G good, because whether or not it's a wonderful, like, life full of experiences, it's a glimpse of wonder. I mean, the thing about the circus is that it is trying to defy all odds, taking the biggest risk, both financially and with your life, to potentially bring some sense of wonder. And in grasping for that wonder, I think that's where you find that little G. The little G, and a lot of the big G too, is that attempt to do something amazing. Because if they do it amazing, that's great. You make something amazing. That's how it is for everyone else there. But in trying to get there, that's the thought that counts. That is the thought that, how can I genuinely engage these people?
And so does that make you feel more hopeful for what you're doing now, that you're trying to do something and it doesn't have to necessarily succeed in the biggest way, but the attempt is where the work comes in?
My life is spread across politics, circus organizations, nonprofits, that theater, music, and I've realized that, you know, with all of those, that is the circus. Having all of those things and the intersections, and you know, it's, life is a circus. Every little detail that you manage to like sew into your life. Like, I think that the fact that I'm like a Jets fan is such a circusy thing. It doesn't make sense for me to be into professional sports, but I do it because these are incredible athletes setting themselves so far apart by putting on a spectacle. Like, that's a circus. Like, that,
yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's so universal to me. And I think that it's so overlooked at the same time.
Yeah, that is a really fascinating way to look at that. Like, circus is such a specific type of lens on the world that I imagine when you come to a situation that, like, when I come to it, I'm seeing something that might just look like, I don't know, media, but to you, this you see it through the lens, the funhouse mirror, or even the like the honest mirror of circus. Right? And so do you see things differently? I mean, I think that's almost going back to the bravery aspect of, to me, right, talking to an adult is terrifying, you know, less now that I am an adult, but can imagine at 17, talking to an adult would be terrifying. But for someone who grew up in the circus or, you know, understands that it's kind of just theater, did that give you a little bit of bravery? And even still?
Absolutely. I mean, I think especially the performing arts high school I went to, I'll give them a lot of credit. They had some great, great theater training. And that set me up to really understand empathy on a lot of levels, you know, tactical conversation, how to understand people, how to gain perspective a lot of the time, the right questions to ask, because you have to learn how to be another person, and that's what they're training you to do. So that was a huge step. And on the circus aspect, it's like, you know, from when I'm looking at media or within my work and within organizing, a lot of the work that you have to do within the political sphere is awareness and getting information and disseminating, you know, information to organizers and getting them to go out and take that and bring it somewhere else. And so learning just how to go on stage and get the people in the front row at least to look at what you're doing, to get engaged, to ask for applause, to keep them engaged throughout, even like, you know, when you're creating an hour and a half long circus, how do you keep these people engaged? So whenever I look at something like, you know, if March for Science is having an event in a month, I think immediately, well, who would first of all want to see this? How are you going to get to the people that want to see this kind of stuff? Because they're out there. And how do you keep them engaged? How do you really say, we see and hear how you're feeling and what you want. We're going to do that for you. We're going to try our best to cater to each and every person. Because that's what the circus, it's finding, there's something for everyone in the circus, right? And so how do you make everything you do accessible to everyone? Because it's not impossible. I mean, you know, like everyone has its niche, like, and not everyone would be interested in the conversation that like two guys that look like us are having, but it's not impossible to make everything as, you know, radically accessible. And that I think the circus has proven that. And that's what affects my lens the most.
Yeah, I keep coming back to what a talent for an activist to come from. And I guess projecting forward, how do you want to meld these worlds more in your future?
So my largest issue with my role and like obviously the environment of the activism sphere is that, and obviously we're all culprits of it, it's a high ego, high stakes place that leaves a lot of people ostracized. It leaves a lot of people burnt out. It's a very, you know, cutthroat kind of thing. I mean, you have a bunch of organizations, advocates, activists that are kind of all competing in a lot of ways for a very small amount of funding for awareness advocacy campaigns, for, you know, trying to motivate the people who are trying to push the world to do the right things, to change the way we live. And so it's really hard. So in the future, I try to look towards things that I want to do, because, you know, you have to ask yourself as an activist, who am I every day? You guys say, like, who am I helping? What good am I doing for the world right now? And I think that I can do that more effectively with clowning, and a lot more personally too. Obviously, we need people who are going to push forward the global, you know, saving the world agenda, because there is one and we need to do it. But at the same time, there are kids growing up every day in neighborhoods where they don't have enough food to eat. Their parents don't have the childcare support so that they are taken care of all the time. They don't have a lot of extracurricular activities because funding are pulled from their communities. So in the future, I want to really become, and I'm already starting to do this, I just joined the board of my parents' organization called Laughter League, which facilitates their hospital programs, their school programs. They have like a few different school shows that they bring into schools, and it teaches, you know, basic level science, math, English, stuff like that. And also this new project that we've been working on called Circo Caravan, where pretty much we go into a community that is greatly underserved, and we bring food, and we teach a free workshop and give a free show for the whole community, and it's free to
Certain.
everyone. So what
Yeah.
I'm, coming from the world of activism, I look at my parents, who are the most well-meaning people in the world, and say, okay, how do we make this actually as progressive as possible? How do we support these communities, not just by what we think we need to give them, but what they actually need? How do we give them the child support, the food they need, while still giving our message of circus and sharing the circus with them? Because you can do those things together. And I think it's one of the best way to do those.
Hell yeah, man. I think that's a fabulous way for us to start to bring this conversation to a close. So, before we get into like plugs or anything like that, if you had to give not even advice, but just like people are struggling all the time, you know? And when you wake up in the morning, what keeps you up there?
This is a controversial answer because this takes a lot of time from me. But I've grown up as a native internet user, and that's caused, I think that a lot of us have developed and now have unmedicated attention disorders because of the way that we've grown up with social media. So it's taken everything from us and also given us everything at the same time. And TikTok, the very popular app, is quite literally the largest circus I have ever seen. And that is one of the things that keeps me up there, is remembering that people can get other people to look at them, to create community with the smallest talents ever. I don't know how much time you've spent on TikTok, but
My
it is.
girlfriend is on it all the time.
Right, it's a vaudeville show in nature. People bring their 30 seconds, their 60 seconds to so, and people are swiping to say, "Yeah, this is awesome," or "Nope, try again next time." And it is a way for people to share what they have in the most niche of ways. And I think, TikTok being one of the smaller facets of the larger internet ecosystem, but that's what keeps me going, aside from the people close around me.
Oh yeah. So everybody, Chet Monday, Chet, if people want to take part in some of the activism that you're doing or find you out in the world of the internet, the big circus, where should they look for you?
So my internet tags, my Instagram is Chet_Monday. You can hear more about March for Science at marchforscience.org. And then the same for Laughter League, my parents' organization, at laughterleague.org.
And I'll link to all of those in the show notes. Everybody, I have, as always, have been your host, Alex Schiffman. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of At Least There's This. It feels really good to be back in the studio, having good conversations with the people I love to curate for you. If you like this episode, like, subscribe, share it with a friend. I don't really advertise, so any word of mouth goes a long way. Thanks again, and I can't wait to be in your headphones again soon. Bye. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. So, Chet, huh? Pretty impressive guy. Talking to people like Chet, I come away thinking about a lot. First, obviously, I come away thinking about my own inadequacies. The dude is young and, handsome, but that's neither here nor there, and he's fearlessly put himself out there to make a difference in the world, which is something I feel totally at sea about doing. Like I'm sure a lot of you, I have a great want to change things, but I often feel lost as how to do so. It feels like when I was in high school and I knew that sex happened, but I didn't have a clue as to how you got there from here. The other thing talking to people like Chet makes me think about is related to that, and that's fantasy. Not sexual fantasy, but fantasy like the genre, fantasy fiction. I don't know how many of you listening, if there are any of you listening, know this, but I'm also a fantasy author. I've written one novel, and I'm 2/3 of the way through my second. I haven't been published, but I am trying to respect the effort I've put in rather than only allow myself to feel proud when there's external validation. That might never come, and that will make me feel like shit for the rest of my life. So, I am an author. But what does that have to do with the conversation that I just had? One of my favorite writers, who sadly passed away just before I learned about him, is the American anthropologist David Graeber. I think I've mentioned his books on this podcast or others before. In a book of essays he wrote about the nature of bureaucracy titled The Utopia of Rules, he devotes a lot of pages to the concept of fantasy fiction. See, Graeber grew up in the 60s and 70s when the future was promised to be this utopian destination where the world would be exactly as we all wanted it to be. Flying cars and food printers and space travel and, you know, all that shit. But the world that we've gotten is sadly lacking. I'm a science communicator, and I follow a lot of other sci-commers on Twitter, and it irks me every time I see someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson wax poetic about how cool cell phones are. We're living in the future. You go back in time and you tell people that they have these marvelous black boxes, and those cavemen of the 1900s would dance with glee. I mean, maybe. But major tech innovations haven't improved too much since the 60s. We don't have clean drinking water for a lot of the world, we've eroded our environment, and we've only made social divisions worse. A cell phone is sort of a booby prize for all that. Yeah, I can go on Twitter, but I'm still driving basically the same car that my parents were driving. I mean, the brakes are a little bit better, and I can connect to it with Bluetooth, but it isn't what people were hoping for. Graeber points to this disappointment as one of the causes of fantasy. It's a genre not just of escapism, but it's a type of fiction that at once subverts and yet reifies the disappointing world we're stuck in. Ah, the reader says, how much I too would like to be Simon from the Dragonbone Chair, fighting and going on grand adventures. The world I'm stuck in is so drab and boring. And yet, that world of fantasy shows just how perilous it would be to live in a world without the bureaucratic and technocratic things that we have now. It would be a grimy, stinky world of only the strong survive. So you escape into the fantasy, only to come back to a reality unchanged. Graeber calls those worlds up to contrast them to the worlds of the imagination held by activists. Unlike those who want to live in a world of fantasy, content to be Hufflepuffs and Gryffindors, an activist's fantastic imaginary world is one hoped for in the future. One where actual change is needed, demanded, but most importantly, seen as still genuinely possible. I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Otto, be quiet. Otto, stop.